From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
Many people would say politics in Canberra in recent years has become one long satire. Certainly, it's provided a wealth of material for the real satirists. The Wharf Review is a satirical show that pokes fun at political players, whether local or foreign. It's long been a feature of the Sydney theatre scene, and currently the show is running to appreciative audiences in Canberra. To talk about the artist sending up the politicians, we've invited in today Jonathan Biggins. He's one of the co-creators, writers, and performers of The Wharf Review. Jonathan Biggins, you and your fellow cast members were in Question Time last week. What were your impressions?
Well, I always find Question Time a fairly depressing place to be. But we were here as guests of Tony Burke, and we were in the gallery watching. And I think the Deputy Prime Minister was making elaborate gestures on one of their Question Time memes where, you know, they pick what we're going to do, and they were taking the hammer. The AOP was going to take the big sledgehammer to pensioners or someone. And Tony Burke got up on a point of order and said, "Mr. Speaker, for the dignity of the Parliament, could I remind the Honourable Member that the cast and crew of The Wharf Review are in the gallery, and I find his auditioning weird." And we thought, well, that's very brave, seeing that half the gallery wouldn't have a clue who we were. But the Speaker actually said, "You've made a valid point."
Recognition. So did you get any fresh material?
Not really, although I admired Tony Abbott's slow walk to get a glass of water for he and his best friend Kevin Andrews. And it was funny seeing Julie Bishop up the very back. So I guess, you know, we noted Mr. Abbott's walk yet again.
I think that's been mastered, though, hasn't it, in your
it's yes,
show?
We've reached that point. I've done Tony Abbott in many different guises over the years. This year I'm playing him as the evil stepmother in a hooped skirt. Last year I was in a green lycra all-in-one as the complete joker. And I think one year I did a fan dance, which was just speedos and tassels. And that's an image that is burnt into many people's minds that cannot be removed.
You don't find yourself walking like this down to the shops?
Well, I am having a hip replacement shortly, so yes, I do find it a little more.
Now, tell us something about the origins of The Wharf Review.
Well, the review started, it kind of emerged. Philip Scott, Drew Forsyth and myself were doing a show called Three Men and a Baby Grand, which was just a sort of more of, you know, cabaret. We'd met actually doing an ABC TV political satire called The Dingo Principle, and Phil had worked on the Gillies Reports and those sort of programs. And then in 2000, the STC said, "Oh, you know, we'd like to do a show." Wayne Harrison said, "Yeah, why don't you come do a show here, a Millennium Review?" And then Robin Nevin sort of took the ball and ran with it, and she kind of pushed us more into the political world. And ever since then, we've done pretty much exclusively political satire, year in, year out.
So how do you choose your targets?
Well, you know, the traditional cry is that satire tends to be, you know, it's all your lefties and your bleeding hearts who do comedy and entertainment. They always attack the conservatives. But for the bulk of the time that we have been doing it, it has been the conservatives who have been in power. And I think with political satire, you do tend to target governments more because governments are active, governments are doing things, and oppositions tend to sit there fairly quietly. So it really is kind of directed primarily at the ruling party of the day. We find state politics doesn't really resonate very much with people. There have been a few.
Maybe it would in New South Wales at the moment.
Well, it does a bit, but it's not as interesting for some reason. I don't know why. There have been a few notable exceptions. We did a big section on Barry O'Farrell as the sort of sheriff come in to clean up the Wild West, and that had a whole range of characters.
With a bottle in hand.
Well, yes, Clover Moore, Fred Nile, and the young Gladys Berejiklian before she ascended to the lofty heights of Premier. So that tends to be it, world politics, world issues. But we've found also over the time, and I'm sure you find this as well, that a week may be a long time in politics, but 20 years is nothing. And the issues largely remain the same, and they go on unresolved. So we find ourselves constantly challenged by trying to find new ways to do the same old issues.
I did notice in your show that Bill Shorten doesn't get much of a Guernsey, I think a passing reference. Do you expect that he'll be a good subject if he becomes Prime Minister?
He's a tricky one. We did actually have a sketch in before we came to Canberra, an ALP caucus sketch to the tune of sit down, you're rocking the boat, as various people were suggesting, policy ideas that were knocked very quickly on the head. But it wasn't quite working, so we just cut it. I mean, that is the beauty of what we do, is that we can change and manipulate things, and if things aren't really working. But unfortunately, that was our only real reference to the ALP, but it just dramaturgically wasn't helping the show, so we cut it.
Well, you may have to go into a bit more detail and research in a year or so.
Oh, I think we will, yes. I mean, we're just grateful that there's no early election, because the leadership spill happened 2 weeks into rehearsal, so we were able to change it. But one memorable year, we were coming down to Canberra. I think we're driving down on the Monday night listening to the news that Malcolm was about to roll Tony. So we stayed up all night rewriting the entire, well, a lot of it, for the opening night that on the Tuesday. So we have been in that situation. There was the year when the independents took 10 days to decide who they were going to go with. So we're hanging on tenterhooks there. I think we were doing a Rudd sketch when they went from opposition to government. So that was being altered. But, it keeps you on your toes.
Your scripts are quite edgy. How do you make judgments, or what sort of judgments do you make about how far to go?
Well, this is always the interesting question, and there's always people who say, oh, it's not edgy enough, it's not biting enough, it's not cutting. We try to operate without malice. And I've been thinking about this lately, and I think it's actually becoming increasingly important to do that. And what always surprises me is that we are able to get audiences from both sides of the political spectrum to equally enjoy the show. We do a season up at French's Forest in Sydney, which is right in the heart of Tony Abbott's electorate. Bronwyn Bishop had the adjoining seat. And it sells extremely well to a very conservative audience who maybe not laugh quite as much, but they enjoy it. And I think I'm beginning to see that the most valuable thing we can do, in particularly in these very partisan times, is unite a group of people in a theatre. And that's the great thing about the theatre, is that you are sitting there with 500 other people and you're looking at yourselves and you're laughing and you're sharing that experience that only you can share that night with your fellow human beings. And I think we need to get more of that back into politics. And online satirists, and you know, everyone's an online satirist now. No sooner has something happened than 20 seconds later there's a meme or a funny thing. But it's made by someone sitting alone and shown to other people who are sitting alone. I think the great thing about theatrical satire is that you get a gang of people together and they can remind each other that, in the words of the famous Australian cartoon of the guy hanging off the clock and the other man hanging off his trousers, "For God's sake, stop laughing, this is serious."
Well, I think that there's been a lot more criticism, for example, of satirical sketches on the ABC in recent years. Do you find that you get that sort of negative feedback, or do you think that's partly caught up with the whole debate around the ABC? The politicians seem really sensitive, or some of them, to satire on the national broadcaster.
Yes, and they always have been. I mean, everyone forgets that, you know, Bob Hawke declared the ABC the enemy of the people. You know, I think after the first interview with Richard Carlton, that was a serious interview. I think the recent controversies have been lapses of taste and judgment on the parts of the satirists. I mean, you know, they were pretty feeble jokes. No offence, but, you know, they were going for the shock value and they got it. So you kind of lay yourself open to that. But I don't think anyone's ever complained about Sean McAuliffe, for example, which is a slightly higher level. But I think the pressure of that, and I think you're referring to the Tonightly, the Tom Ballard program, I mean, the pressure that they are under to produce that amount of TV every night is ridiculous. And I think, you know, we look at the American late night hosts, they've got 20 people sitting in a room writing that. And I think they're under enormous amount of pressure, and sometimes things slip through, and then opportunistically the opponents seize on it and the faux outrage happens. But then again, I think what we have to be equally careful of is self-censorship. And I think we are entering an age of a new Puritanism that is actually not only driven by the censorious right, but by the equally censorious left, who are saying this is no longer acceptable. You cannot say this anymore. You can't do that anymore. And I kind of agree with Stephen Fry when he said that no one has the right to not be offended. But we're entering difficult waters in that regard.
So do you feel that in writing this material, political correctness is a real constraint?
I think it can be, and it will be. I think we're entering that period. I mean, I obviously, you know, as a bleeding heart, inner west lefty, I think political correctness began with the best of motivations and the best of intentions, but it has kind of crept into an area where things like nuance, ambiguity, irony, all those great drivers of the satirical tradition are in danger of being lost. And I think we have to be very careful
about
that.
Have you had any examples of this?
I have myself. I wrote a play called Australia Day some years ago, which was about a small regional town and the committee putting on Australia Day. It was a political satire. The local mayor, he was actually trying for pre-selection for the Liberal Party. The local Greens candidate caught him out in some shady doings and used that as political leverage to further her political career. And it was all set against the backdrop of preparing for and the day of Australia Day. An amateur company in Albury, Wodonga, were going to put it on, and some local Indigenous people, without having read it or seen it, objected. Simply on, the nature of the title and the fact that it's a very sensitive issue for, a lot of people. But eventually they pressured the company to drop it. And I think that happened in Griffith as well. And I thought, I don't know that that's such a good idea. I think, traditionally it's been people like Fred Nile who demand things be banned before they've read or seen them. So I think that's the danger. And pressure is being brought to bear on... We've always had a free rein at the review, but... I can see shadows appearing at the door to maybe tighten that.
And where are those shadows originating from? Is this in terms of funding or audience reaction? Or?
Concerned management. Need we say more?
Coming back to the question of the audience, and you're talking about people not being unhappy about their sort of political allies being sent up and so on. What's been the reaction from politicians, and do you often have politicians in the audience?
Yes, we do. I mean, funnily enough, Bronwyn Bishop was one of our great early supporters. The aforementioned Barry O'Farrell laughed uproariously at his sketch, but his wife sat stony-faced beside him. Keating and Hawke came. I mean, I famously do Keating. I don't know that Mr. Keating is too thrilled about that. In fact, I have it on good authority that he's not. Bob Hawke didn't mind. I don't think Julia Gillard has ever seen it. I don't think Rudd or Abbott. Not sure about Turnbull. But, people like Tanya Plibersek. And we actually came down and did the ALP caucus staff annual dinner at the press club. It was quite fun. But it's frightening to know that there are staffers in Bill Shorten's office who weren't even born when Keating was Prime Minister.
Well, which leads to the question of this has been long running. Are you happy to sort of see it go on year after year, or do you feel that you want to do something very different?
I would like to do something very different. I think, everything has a shelf life. But the thing is, there doesn't seem to be any end of the demand for it. And thankfully, our audiences are starting to skew a bit younger. Not that I have anything against an older audience, because it is the only growing demographic in the country, but younger people are becoming more engaged and enjoying it, which is odd because sometimes some of the references we use are fairly arcane. We're doing a panto this year, and I think, we have very few musical references beyond 2010. Well, perfectly honest, beyond 1950. But they seem to get it, and they seem to be enjoying it. But I'm not sure how long we can keep going, because you've worked in politics all your life and it's fairly depressing, isn't it?
Do you think it's got more depressing?
Yes. It's
better for your business, though.
Well, in a way, but, as the storms get ever larger and the teacups get ever smaller, it kind of becomes more banal and you're not actually engaging on any sort of deeper level. Not that we engage on a very deep level anyway, but there aren't as many colourful characters, that's for sure. And then the ones...
But there are characters behaving more colourfully.
There are, but you don't really want to give them oxygen. Like, I always feel in 2 months about playing Donald Trump. I mean, it's a gift in one way. But it's interesting to note, because last year when we did it, we had him sort of hosting his own Tonight Show, and Angela Merkel, Boris Johnson and Putin were the guests. And that was fun. But this year, particularly in Canberra, I'm noticing a slight... not hostility, but a sense of the audience has wearied of Mr. Trump. And I think, if anything, the saturation media coverage that he's had ever since he got in, people are just getting sick of it. And you look back and we all have the rosy glow of nostalgia for the great leaders of the past, but they had the luxury of not governing with social media. The news cycle was a week Or, you know, Malcolm Fraser could famously say, politics does not belong on the front page of the newspaper, but now you can't avoid it, and it's updated every 10 minutes. So I think it becomes increasingly difficult. I think social media is actually the enemy of democracy, not its ally. And you can sort of track the deterioration in the level of political debate, fairly direct correlation with the introduction of Twitter. But that genie's well and truly out of the bottle, so I don't know how you put it back in.
It's interesting the point you make about the audience tiring of figures or characters. They don't seem to tire of Keating.
No.
And you've got a long sketch, monologue sketch, which you do in your current show. Do you think that Keating has become, in a sense, more popular as time goes on? Because, of course, he was thrown out and very unpopular at that time.
Yes. I had a friend whose 90-year-old mother came and saw the show on Saturday, and she said, I've never liked Paul Keating until today.
How did you read that?
I thought, that's good. I've actually written a one-man show about Keating, which I'm going to be doing next year, and I was beginning to think, maybe he's a bit past it and maybe it's too late. I've missed the boat. But the Keating sketch in this year's review only went in because Drew Forsyth was doing Pauline Hanson. He got a hernia and had to pull out of the show temporarily. He'll be back for Sydney. So we needed something to go in, so I just hastily cobbled together a Keating. And rich pickings with the debacle in the Liberal Party and also, you know, the echo of the DLP split of the 1950s, which Keating grew up with. So it was a nice kind of, you know, bookend, and that all parties have these ideological splits that just, in the long run, do no one any favours. So he was able to wax lyrical about that and give his opinions on the plotters and their ineptitude. And I was surprised, but again, even in Abbott's electorate, they applaud Mr. Keating when he comes out, and I think, yes, we haven't seen you for a while, and would you please come back?
So what will be the theme of the whole Keating new show?
Well, I'm not going to do his private life. I think that is not my business. But I'll do his public life pretty much from day one. And it's actually, again, interesting that the more fascinating parts of it, for me, are the old stuff. And when we get into what is within our contemporary memories, it's not quite as interesting, probably because we know more about it.
Which bits of the old stuff?
Well, his early years, I mean, his pre-selection. I love the fact that he bought a bus from Mary War and painted it up JFK style, and he was so proud of it, he drove it over to Maroubra to show Bob Carr's parents. Stuff like that. I think that's gold.
Well, I'd expect that he'd be there on the opening night because...
Oh, he may not be.
You think not?
No, I think he enjoyed Keating the musical because that was a love poem to him. But again, it's difficult because I'm trying to find... You can slate home to Mr. Keating and the Hawke Keating government some of our ills today, because he did unleash neoliberalism on this country with a vengeance. He would argue that it was badly managed after he came second. But it's very hard when you're playing a character like that to introduce the critical voice. How do you do it? So that's the challenge we're facing at the moment, because, shall we say, he would not be a man to easily admit mistakes.
Indeed. Jonathan Biggins, thank you very much for talking with The Conversation today. And that's all from our podcast. Thank you to my producer, Eliza Berlage. We'll be back with another interview soon, but goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevere. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.